You blush, you stammer, you wish to shrink out of sight, but there's no avoiding them. Awkward moments, that is. Those times like belly buttons that everybody has. Though we know that every single one of us has blundered, we concoct some elaborate methods to avoid the embarrassment. Today's Mind's Eye Radio writers come clean about their special moments of pain in Awkward Moments, or The Real Faux Pas. When laypersons think of math and mathematicians, we're likely to imagine beings who spend entire days in a special place in which nothing is questionable or arbitrary, where things simply proceed in logical fashion without the messiness of human error. Nice to imagine, but mathematician Lewis Rawl puts the lie to all that rationality.
Hello, Dr. Stringlove here. I've been told to go sit in the science corner of Mind's Eye Radio, even though what happened in the lab was not my fault. It makes me feel a little better to remember that famous scientists have awkward moments, too. One that happened to Bob Oppenheimer comes to mind. I call it the story of the disasterisk. You all know what an asterisk is. It's that little star after an announcement of a good deal, which points to a footnote in fine print, which says you can't possibly qualify for the deal, or something similar. Since asterisk, which means little star, is hard to pronounce, most people just call it a star. In mathematics, a star is sometimes used to denote the conjugate of a complex number. You don't have to know what a complex conjugate is. The important thing is a complex number z and its conjugate z star are not equal unless z is a real number. Since x and y usually denote real numbers, we're pretty much stuck with z as a generic complex number. This is the way mathematicians think. Back to Bob Oppenheimer. He is best known as the father of the atom bomb. Before he did to all of us what fathers do, he was a professor at the University of California in Berkeley. One of my physics professors took a course from him, and this is what happened during a lecture. Since it was told to me by a professor, it has to be true. Bob was explaining something in a famous book by an even more famous physicist. To do this, he had to derive an equation in the book. This means taking other equations understood to be true and forming a new equation which has to be true even if not as well understood. The equation in the book ended with a star, indicating complex conjugation. Bob worked hard and came up with an equation which was the same, except that it didn't end with a star. It was a complicated derivation, so Bob told the class he must have slipped up somewhere and went through the calculations once more. Again, no star. The famous book was open on his desk to the page with the equation, and the star was clearly there. Time was running out. Bob wearily picked up the chalk to try again when a small, scared voice was heard from the back of the room. Professor Oppenheimer, I think that star is for a footnote. Yes, it was just an asterisk. Or for Bob, a disasterisk. This is Dr. Stringlove adding yet another footnote to Mind's Eye Radio. Disaster means evil star, from the days when the stars controlled everything. It follows that a disasterisk is just a mishap, or in this case, an awkward moment.
Thank you.
People react differently to their close encounters with the extremely awkward. Some of us may pretend nothing's happened, while others might even utter the words one hates to hear, like your surgeon mid-appendectomy muttering, "Uh-oh." It is these "uh-oh" moments that writer Esther Cameron parses in the following piece.
Uh-oh. Stephen Crane is best known for The Red Badge of Courage and other fiction, but he also wrote a number of small, uncomfortable free-verse poems, such as the following. The Wayfarer. The wayfarer, perceiving the pathway to truth, was struck with astonishment. It was thickly grown with weeds. "Ha," he said, "I see that no one has passed here in a long time." Later he saw that each weed was a singular knife. "Well," he mumbled at last, "doubtless there are other roads." I read that in high school, and it has haunted me ever since. I think it captures the quality of a kind of moment we all experience, what I call the uh-oh moment. The moment when you see something you would really rather avoid thinking about, like a naked emperor. The twinge that marks it feels a little like the embarrassment of a social gaffe. Most of us are pretty good at smoothing such moments over, changing the subject of our mental conversation. But, of course, there aren't really any other roads. It always catches up with us at last. It is often said that truth is elusive and difficult to come by, and no doubt that statement has been useful in diffusing altercations. Yet I have this sneaking suspicion that the truth is there somewhere, and most of us basically know it. We have just gotten very good at misplacing it. There used to be a saying, though a Google search failed to trace it, that truth is naked at the bottom of a well. Maybe those uh-oh moments are voices from that well. If all of us were to keep track of such moments, we might eventually be able to compose a model of the elephant about which even seven blind men could agree. The resolve and practice of listening to one's uh-oh moments might be the equivalent of a scientific discipline. With time, and no doubt with a certain number of lacerations suffered by the pioneers, the weeds might be trampled down a bit. There would be fewer uh-oh moments and more aha moments when you glimpse truth in its wondrous and delightful aspect. Of course, when people become too phobic about getting scratched, the weeds grow higher, the truth gets uglier and uglier, harder and harder to face. Looking around for the Band-Aids, I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
There's more than one illusion about growing up in the 60s, not the least of which is the notion that anyone raised in that era has been somehow duly educated by the Kinsey Report, and therefore indoctrinated into the world of free love and unashamed sex. Sex had come out of the box, become a natural part of who we are. It was okay if you weren't with the one you love. Just love the one you're with. And it was finally proven that, without a doubt, women experienced orgasms. Americans had become sexier than ever. Well, some of us. As usual with any popular social movement, the press managed to blithely ignore the fact that most Americans remained sexually tame, and in fact prefer things just as they were. My family seemed to be part of that contingent. Sex was never mentioned in our house, other than my father occasionally joking that, despite us having 6 kids, he had never actually seen my mother naked. And when our pet dachshund, Schnapsy, started humping some visitor's leg, we all just ignored it. So as an adult, it took me well into my 20s to begin ridding myself of the shameful notions of sex. Then, when I was 30, I moved to Scotland, and my eyes opened a bit wider. Europeans were more laid back, more open towards the body. One winter, I moved to Germany to live with my girlfriend Kirsten's parents. Then I realized how not so far I had come. Kirsten's parents lived in a quaint village built on the ruins of a castle. Dad was a teacher and Mom worked part-time as a secretary. I wasn't working and my girlfriend was a busy midwife, so I was often left in the company of her mom. To begin with, relating to her mom at all was awkward because of her name, Dirt. I simply could not say it to her directly without trying to make it sound like something else. I called her Dirte or Deidre, but of course, being German, she would correct me. Dirt it was. I'd had the same experience in England ordering spotted dick for dessert. It just sounded nasty. But Dirt and I got on well, preparing meals for the family and occasionally going for walks in the nearby section of the Black Forest. One evening, when Kirsten was called away to attend a birth, Dirt invited me to go to the local spa for a swim and some sauna. As it was the dead of winter, I accepted. Once at the spa, Dirt and I went to our respective changing rooms and agreed to meet in the sauna. I automatically assumed that since the sauna was co-ed and this was a public spa, that strategically wrapped towels were required. But as I stepped from the shower room to the sauna and pool area, my towel demurely wrapped around my waist, I saw the towels were only used for what they were invented. I was surrounded by a sea of mostly jiggling flesh, a herd of spetzel and schnitzel bread bodies. I panicked and was about to turn to the shower room and feign illness when Dirt called out my name. I glanced her way, squinting in fear. Her towel was in full use, wrapped around her wet hair like a turban. Everything below was as bare as the newborn baby her midwife daughter was helping come into that world while we were at the sauna. If Dirt scented any of my dire discomfort, she didn't flinch, and into the sauna we went, me still clutching my towel around my waist. But that only lasted so long. After the sauna, we went naked swimming, and then we lounged naked in poolside chairs, nakedly drinking fruit juice. Most of the night I kept to the side of Dirt and talked to her out of the side of my mouth. Finally, Dirt announced that she had a surprise for me. She was going to treat me to a massage. 999, I protested, but she would not hear it. She led me to a poolside room, me following, trying unsuccessfully not to make any comparison between her bare behind and my girlfriend's. In the massage room, there was, thank God, a fully clothed woman. Better yet, a fully clothed, old, grouchy-looking woman. And for the next hour, Helga pummeled me into submission by the most painful massage I had ever experienced, involving much pounding and ja, sehr gut grunting. Helga obviously was used to more thickly padded people, and consequently I felt like every rib had been bruised. But I didn't care. I felt I surely deserved it for running around naked with my girlfriend's mother. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio. We'll be right back.
In the Trenches, Terrifying Tales of Teaching, Norma Gay Pruitt revisits a few days in the classroom that could happen to anyone, and did.
Anyone who melds young minds knows the pluses and the pitfalls of teaching. My first day, I experienced rigor mortis to the point that my fellow teaching assistants had to walk me around as one walks out a racehorse with a sprain, except that I was just a pony, and this was not the Preakness, but the first day of the first year of my teaching actual human students in a college classroom. Eventually, my friends hurled me into the classroom, and I skidded to a stop, staring at my hands while my knuckles on the edge of the desk became cyanide blue. I was 21 or 22 and short. I am still short, but have now taught for 25 years. Eventually, I looked up and saw 25 pairs of scared eyes and 25 little scared faces. They were 18 years old and having their first day of college. Mine might have been their very first college class ever. We all began to relax, and except for a brief spate of dizziness and lumpy throatedness as I began to grasp the magnitude of what I was actually pretending to be, I have sailed through. Sometimes, though, on a day when I am particularly unprepared, that first day returns in vivid color. And like most teachers, I have the typical first day nightmares the night before I start teaching each fall. Mine features the chancellor calling me the morning of the first day and announcing that they are sorry, but they have enough English teachers and have placed me in math. Me, who has more calculus on her teeth than in her head. I plead with them that they really don't want me teaching anything in math, but they tell me that I am teaching math or teaching nothing. Oh yeah, and I am frequently naked in this dream too. It doesn't take Freud to figure this one out, does it? Only because these tales of teaching terror are so common can I begin to take a little solace. One of my former roommates, a dedicated ingenue, wanted to try what was then a bit of newfangled technology, the film strip. Remember film strips? The rattling wheel of the film take-up, the grainy view? My friend actually got the thing going. Teachers were no better prepared to handle technology then than now. But the picture was postage stamp sized. Let's all move forward, she suggested. Chairs scraped and kids obligingly began gathering around the tiny picture. Finally, one brave soul spoke up in the dark. Miss Jones, he said carefully, you know that if you move that projector backwards, the picture will get bigger. Miss Jones never told me how she recovered from this awkward moment in the teaching trenches. Another teacher friend told me that he was told to always check his fly before facing the class. Therefore, he breezed into the classroom, wrote his name on the board with a flare, turned to his students, and began to sense some discomfort. Only after leaving the classroom did he discover the chalk outline of his hand on the front of his pants. Then there are the things that happen while talking and walking, the portable faux pas. Backing up rapidly one day, maintaining eye contact, I was kneecapped by the wastebasket and took a cedar right into the container. Another day, I hooked the hem of my skirt and dragged a chair around by the book rack on its side for several agonizing seconds while trying to disengage. Another friend turned to the board suddenly and dislodged a pair of pantyhose that had chosen that moment to lose their static cling on the underside of her skirt. Thankfully, I have not experienced the audible flatulence that one of my notorious college professors was known for. One day, he bent to retrieve something and not only cut a terrible fart, but split his pants simultaneously. It kind of makes my minor awkward moments pale, and for that, I gratefully thank you, O gods of the lectern. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, survivor for Mind's Eye Radio.
I'm not a big guy.
Madison writer Ron Kuka.
I'm currently 5'8 with my socks on. As a kid, I was almost always the smallest boy in my class. "He's tiny" was a comment I could count on hearing when I arrived at a new school. Our family moved a lot. Traditionally, short boys can take two roads. The first and safest is to become a comedian. Have a quip ready that will deflect a comment by a larger party who notes that you seem to be the perfect size to fit into, say, a gym locker. The second is to compensate in the opposite direction, to become a tough guy, develop a swagger. Almost everybody now has a story about a pushy, short boss. I've also found that along with bad ex-boyfriends, their names tend to be Dwayne or Ron. Now, though my name happens to be Ron, I went with the comedian route. Safer. And though I joined the wrestling team, the traditional sport for small guys, I did it because my uncle was a wrestling coach and needed lightweights. Attending a high school that didn't offer gymnastics, boxing, or jockey training, what could I do? I also developed trouble radar. I'd been on the wrong end of a couple of fights in elementary school, and a raised voice or aggressive stance triggered alarms in me. I hated fights. It worked, too, all through high school, not a single humiliating incident. Even years later, working in a salmon cannery in Kodiak, Alaska, where, it seemed, fights broke out every night in the bunkhouse, and where my best friend Tweeba, a very big guy from Samoa, said he'd pay money to see me fight, I'd managed to avoid trouble until the fisherman's strike broke and the salmon seiners went out to fish. For cannery workers, that meant that we would now be employed around the clock for a couple of exhausting months. In the meantime, we had a short 2 days before the boats returned. Most of us walked up to the anchor bar, just upwind from the smell of the cannery, to tip a couple and await the fish. I was late, it seems. By the time I got there, the crowd, including my friend Tweeva and several of his relatives, had been squeezed out of the bar and onto a large deck. He waved me over. I pushed through the mob. Olympia and Rainier cans lay mangled on the table as if one had to first stock and kill the container before drinking its guts. At 9 o'clock p.m. it was bright out. This was Alaska, and we still had 3 more hours of sunlight. My friend from the cannery, Carol, was sitting next to Tweeva. She looked miserable. "You have any aspirin?" she said. I shrugged, but volunteered to walk her to the bunkhouse. An hour later, the deck was bulging at the rails, and the only place Carol and I found was on the steps leading up from the gravel parking lot. It was so hard to get inside that a few guys had hit the liquor store and were drinking out of their pickups. Carol begged us a couple of beers. Carol had grown up in Portland, Oregon, and had a ready-for-anything kind of demeanor. She was strong, funny, and unafraid. Perfect for Alaska. We just walked past a guy standing alone at the edge of a parking lot. He was tall, thin, dirty, and smelled even by cannery standards. "They call him the Ghost," she told me. He carried a bright orange backpack, the kind issued to Boy Scouts, and it was empty, no sleeping bag, nothing. "He never talks," she said. I guessed that he was waiting for a ride. Though he would glance up at the bar on occasion, the view down toward the dock seemed to interest him more than the commotion behind him. By the time he reached us a few minutes later, I became interested in a story of Carol's about a seiner that had sunk in port. The crew had slept in the bunkhouse and had gone out the next morning to find nothing but a taut rope pointing straight down into the water. I looked up, and there he was, the Ghost, standing in front of Carol. I expected she'd say something to him. She had the reputation of knowing everybody. But he looked mad, like she might have owed him money and he was tired of waiting. I could see that she was puzzled and about to speak when he reached out and grabbed hold of her shirt, pulled her up, and tried to throw her into a pickup. She took an awkward step and started to fall. Before she hit the ground, I grabbed his backpack and pulled. A shoulder strap came loose, but he was luckily still attached at the waist. Carol found her feet and was ready to give him a piece of her mind when he turned and started to swing in my direction. Luckily, he was forced to punch over his rucksack. Though much of this is a blur, the upshot is that we were soon rolling around in the gravel parking lot. My intention was to stay behind him, and I suppose my wrestling experience helped me here. I wanted to immobilize him. I also seemed to believe that by yelling, "What the hell are you doing?" I might clarify the situation. somehow clear things up. Let him know that Carol was not his parole officer. Funny, I know. Funnier, however, to Tuiva, who was now leaning against the deck rail and yelling, "Kick his ass, Ron! You gotta punch him, man!" I didn't want to punch him, though, and could only yell feebly back, "Help me out here!" as we spun around in the dirt. Tuiva was big and liked to fight the way some guys like to play checkers. He laughed when fighting or watching a fight. Carol did her best at times pulling on one leg or the other when I finally had him face down. She'd started yelling, too, cussing at him, and stopped only to catch her breath. He was furious, that was clear. He growled like someone spurred by equal doses of pain and rage. His odor, too, was shocking, something from the Middle Ages. Carol later described it as a little galley slave, a little black death. This was clearly not going to end with a simple explanation. Even on his belly, he'd reach back for an ear or an eye, and once he got a chunk of my hair. Then I did want to punch him. Carol managed to grab one of his fingers and pull his hand away. I was just trying to keep him on the ground until somebody might break us up. It was clear, however, that we'd become the night's featured act. There was whistling, hooting. Over the top, Tuiva's baritone, "Okay, then kick him!" As for me, I was reduced to yelling in the ghost's ear, "Cut it out! Just cut it out!" Though he stopped struggling a couple of times, it never lasted for more than a few seconds. The affair ended with the arrival of the authorities, in this case the appearance of an off-duty cop from inside the bar. I saw him make his way down the steps, and it seemed to me he was moving slowly, tentatively, as if to see if the fight might end before he got there. After reaching us, with a care someone might use crossing a stream, he placed a foot on either side of the ghost's head. I realized then that our rescuer was reeling drunk. "Jerry!" Of course she knew him. He nodded slightly and then reached down, like someone finding a seat in a dark theater, and pressed the side of the ghost's face into the gravel. He seemed to reconsider when his quarry yelled louder and started kicking, and so placed his knee where his hand had been and put some weight to it. Carol seemed amazed that Jerry was carrying handcuffs. It took a couple of awkward minutes to figure the angles and finally get the man cuffed. A couple of his knuckles were bloody. "Get that thing off him!" Jerry looked at me angrily, as if the whole pathetic scene had been my idea. The straps were knotted, so I used my pocket knife to cut them off. It hit me then that I was lucky the ghost hadn't gone for my knife. Within 5 minutes, a police car had arrived, and Mark, the other cop, put the disabled backpack into the front seat after laying the ghost into the back. In the scuffle, the ghost's belt had come loose. He had to walk funny to keep his jeans from falling down. I'd sustained scrapes on my back and elbows. My ear hurt, too, and was throbbing. Crazy some bitch, that was Carol's take as we walked triumphant toward the anchor. She was unhurt and smiling. "My headache's gone," she toasted our barroom prowess. Tuiva was unimpressed. "Ugly," was all he would say. Though I'm sure the whole episode lasted less than 3 or 4 minutes, it put enough adrenaline to me that 2 hours later my left hand still trembled. I was bothered for weeks. People I didn't know in the cannery would start shadowboxing when I entered a room, pretend to duck and then run. My boss would walk towards me with his arms extended, rocking side to side, eyes half closed. He was mimicking the ghost, but he looked to me like Frankenstein's monster. Part of me liked the notoriety, however. The teasing didn't bother me. It was the way the ghost had come out of nowhere. My radar had registered nothing. Why Carol? Why me? I asked around during lunch breaks and found out that he'd been in town for weeks, but that no cannery would put him on, only that people would see him standing by the gates at 5:30 when the bosses showed up. He couldn't have just hitchhiked in. Kodiak is an island, and the only way to get there is by ferry or plane. I figured that even crazy must have an explanation. Where did he sleep? And then there's this. I felt a little guilty. Not because for about 10 seconds, when his fingers were tangled in my hair, that I wanted to kill him, but because I imagined that he was hated and solitary, and that I was a bit player in that story, too. He must have thought something would come through for him in Kodiak. Somebody told him something. At one point, he'd had enough money for a ferry ride. In my story, he was monstrous. In his story, I was another peasant with a pitchfork and a torch. So, here's the unbelievable part. And I'll freely admit that the chances of this happening are minuscule, but there you go. 2 months later, after the end of a grueling salmon season, I'm staying in Seattle with my girlfriend's family. I'm rich from 2 months of overtime pay. Tuivo was back in Hawaii. He could make enough in 3 months in Kodiak to live for the rest of the year in island splendor. Carol was back in Portland and had found a job working in the office for a band called Quarter Flash. I didn't know what to think of a band that had a business office. I'd started listening to blues and had read that Albert King was playing at a small club downtown. This was the early 80s. My girlfriend Debbie and I were making our way on a crowded street when I almost walked into the backpack. The backpack, empty and orange. I moved us to the side next to the plate windows of a drugstore. I was speechless. "What?" she said. I'd told Debbie about the incident in Kodiak and now smiled in anticipation of her incredulous reaction. I stepped onto a curb out of the way and watched as people moved past him like a rock in a stream. "That's really him," I thought. After a couple of minutes, I wondered if he would look over. Would he recognize me? I like thinking that he would. I suppose that's a form of bravado. "Look over here, buddy," I might smile and wave. "Hey, small world." Haunting the ghost and all that. But it never happened. For the most part, he looked down and straight ahead. Every so often, however, he would spot something, a piece of clothing on someone, a hair color perhaps, and his eyes would follow it for a second before jerking back to the small space he'd carved out just in front of him.
Awkward is as awkward does, to twist a borrowed saying from Forrest Gump's mom. But some awkward moments are so well witnessed that there is not a prayer of keeping them quiet once committed. In the second half, we'll hear about gaffes and faux pas of a very public nature. Stick around and squirm with Mind's Eye Radio. Singer-songwriter Lean Patrick Smith may be taking poetic license in his rendition of a much too familiar scenario, but it's hard to believe anyone over 12 hasn't personally encountered the excruciating situation he describes here.
This bar is not where you said you'd be. I can tell you're surprised when you see me, 'cause it was just by fate, just by chance, I stopped in here and I heard you laugh. So tell me I'm wrong, tell me again. My eyes are playing tricks on me when I walked in. That guy you were with, I'm sure he was just a friend. So go ahead, tell me again. He's not who you said you'd be with. You thought you could sneak off and steal a kiss. But I saw your reflection in the barroom mirror. I know you wish I would, but I won't disappear. So tell me you love me, tell me again. Your love is the kind that will never end. I've heard it before, but give it another spin. Yeah, go ahead, tell me again. I doubted your stories in the past, but I never caught you in a lie. This time it'll be hard to convince me, but come on, give it a try. Come on, come on. This night didn't turn out like I planned. Seeing you holding someone else's hand. At first I didn't notice, then I took another look. I recognized him from your high school yearbook. So tell me I'm wrong, tell me again. My eyes were playing tricks on me when I walked in. That guy you were with, I'm sure he was just a friend. So go ahead, tell me again. Tell me again. Tell me again. Come on, come on.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer John Morgan imagines the perils of an innocent bystander whose curiosity puts him in the literal line of fire.
Dan was washing dishes when Steve and Joan, his neighbors across the hall, started up again. It was always the same fight, repeated every night. I just wish you would stop all your frimmering. Frimmering? I'm not the one who frimmers. You're the one who frimmers around here. No, you're the frimmerer. I just can't deal with all your crankulations anymore. Well, how about me? I have to put up with a winkle-pinker like you. Or what about all your connibulations? You think it's any fun putting up with that? My connibulations are nothing compared to all your runkling. I don't runkle half as much as you do. You're a perfect clatter-scrottle, too. I have never clatter-scrottled in my life. Why do you have to be such a jangle-blank? A jangle-blank, Steve exclaimed. That does it. I have to go out for some fresh air. You can't leave now. I haven't finished fighting with you. Oh, yes, you have. At this point, Dan decided to go out for a walk. As he passed the door, Steve walked out, and the vase intended for him caught Dan squarely on the right temple. Dan crumpled to the floor. Joan rushed up to him. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. As she knelt over him, her flowing dark hair brushed his face. He looked up into her large brown eyes and felt a great sympathy for her. Poor Joan, he thought. This must be the most awkward moment of her life. It was then he felt the first faintly stirring pangs of what would have been love at first sight, except that he had seen her many times, although not from that particular perspective. Dan got up, rubbing the lump on his head. There was no blood. I'm all right, he assured them. I just wish you two would learn to get along a little better. What business is it of yours, Steve countered. Why don't you mind your own business? Well, when someone hits me in the head with a vase, I think that's my business. Be nice to him, Steve. It's not his fault. Yeah, sure. It's all my fault because I ducked. Blame it on me. No, Joan answered. It's my fault. I'll take responsibility. Dan was duly impressed. She is a wise woman, he thought. She takes responsibility for her own actions. For the next week, Dan noticed things were pretty quiet across the hall, so they had finally learned to be a little more mature. Then one night, Joan knocked on his door. She was making fudge and didn't have enough sugar. Could she borrow a cup? Dan loaned her a cup of sugar and remarked it was nice to see she and Steve were getting along better. Oh, yeah, we get along a lot better now that we broke up. I kicked him out last week. I'm sorry to hear that, but maybe it was for the best. I think so, Joan agreed. A couple of hours later, she knocked on his door with a small plate of fudge. I'm really sorry about last week, and I want to make it up to you. Well, you didn't have to, but if you insist. I do, and I could use a drink, too. All I have is a bottle of wine, but I'm saving it for a special occasion. Well, we could get to know each other. That would be a special occasion. 2 months later, to Dan's surprise, Joan had moved across the hall and was living with him, and they were getting along fine. Joan told him she was glad to find a man who would listen to her. I don't know why Steve and I didn't get along, she explained to Dan. I've read all the books on how to make a relationship work, but he just wouldn't listen to me. That's why it didn't work, so what could I do? Dan sympathized with her and was happy that she had found someone more compatible who appreciated her, and he was a good listener. The first couple of months, he listened to her daily lecture on how to make your relationship work. He listened attentively, and assumed when she had covered that ground, they could go on to other topics of conversation. After 4 months, he was still listening patiently. 6 months, and his patience was beginning to fray. 8 months, and he realized he had to get away from her. She sensed he was pulling away from her and became argumentative. One day she said to him, "Why do you have to be such a clump shock?" "A clump shock," he said. "I don't have to stand for that. That's a fine thing for a rim flabber to call me. I'm going out for some fresh air. You can't leave now. I haven't finished fighting with you." "Oh, yes, you have," Dan proclaimed. As he tucked the vase under his arm and walked out the door, the clock whizzed past his head. Luckily, he thought, no one was coming. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Tells about a youthful case of mistaken identity.
It's hard in this day and time to imagine how much this incident could be almost shocking to people then. I was probably in early high school, or I would not have been out on a date. At any rate, this didn't get out into the school, fortunately for me, and I never told anyone about it. I think Keith didn't live in town. He was visiting. I was staying overnight with a rather stodgy friend, Midge, who was living with her elderly parents and two older brothers. I was out late on some sort of a date, and it was dark when I tiptoed into the sleeping porch with two twin beds on it. One was in shadow, and I knew her young cousin Keith was visiting would also be sleeping on the porch. I saw only one head on a pillow, and I guessed that Keith was still out, so I crept over to where the head was showing and climbed in. I remember clearly that I thought Midge was taking her half right out of the middle, and I turned my back and shoved her over with my fanny. We definitely did not say but in those times. It was broad daylight when I woke up to find a surprised Keith sitting up in bed and staring at me next to him. Midge was still asleep. "Ah!" I gasped in horror, trying to keep my voice way low. "For heaven's sake, let's not tell anyone about this. I thought you were out last night when I came in, thought your bed was vacant." He was in perfect agreement with this sentiment, a little young to think it was sexy. Midge woke up as I slid into bed next to her and asked me, "Did you have a good time last night?" "Yeah," I replied carefully, "it was okay." And carefully was the way I came into the breakfast table, only to see broad grins on some faces. It was just too good to keep. Midge's older brothers thought it was very amusing, which wasn't the precise way I tried to impress them. Her parents were quite old. I can't remember them saying anything much. Naturally, I explained how I'd come in late, knowing that Midge was already in bed and how the other bed was in the shadow and I thought it was empty. Actually, everyone was very nice about my mistake, and I think I was more embarrassed than humiliated. But it wasn't exactly a bedtime story, either. Midge never told anyone, as far as I know, and we remained good friends for years and years. I didn't tell my folks. I'm not sure if hers actually caught on. It remained just a small secret, maybe joked about in her family. Don't know what Keith thought. He probably told people, but I never saw him again. As I said earlier, it was a small miracle that nothing came out about it in school. But for some reason, it lingers in my memory forever. This is Fran Rahl for Mind's Eye Radio, signing off and hardly ever bed hopping anymore.
These days, we favor euphemisms for some of the plainer words of earlier days. Not so for singer-songwriter Paul Thompson, who prefers the vernacular in Fat Guy Tango.
Years ago, back in the Dark Ages, somebody composed a song called the Too Fat Polka, and the refrain went, "Oh, I don't want her, you can have her, she's too fat for me." It became a pretty popular song, but I always thought the lyrics were a little obnoxious. I felt especially so after getting into ballroom dancing and seeing that some of the best dancers were heavy set or even obese. And this song is dedicated to all those awkward, ugly ducklings who became swans on the dance floor. It's called Fat Guy Tango. "Oh, he's too fat," the girls all say, but when the band begins to play, the girls all go, oh, 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 to see him dance the tango. Watch him glide with a girl, watch him dip her to the floor. Watch him slide, watch him whirl, he's the ballroom matador. All the girls begin to sigh, casting glances at his way. Dance with us, you great big guy, till the break of day. Of romance, sultry, passionate, and slow dance of love tango. Is done, still he dances with just one, silently as in a trance. Still they dance, they dance, still they dance, they dance.
We hope that our true confessions of moments we could have lived without didn't cause you too much discomfort. After all, to err is, well, you know. And we've all had those humbling experiences, haven't we? Here at Mind's Eye Radio, we've simply fessed up. So really now, could your awkward moments be that much worse? That's our show. Thanks for listening to Awkward Moments, or The Real Faux Pas. Mind's Eye Radio is produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Norma Gay Pruitt. Today's blunderers included Esther Cameron, Ron Kuka, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lewis Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Guy Thurvaldsen, and Josephine Zell. Theme music by Barbara Chusid. For more information about upcoming show topics, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com. This and past programs are free for the taking at radio4all.net. That's the number 4. I'm Greg Williard. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio. Radio. Ugh.